lots to talk about again. We've got the all-important US CPI data coming out this week. Heaven forbid if there's another hot print. And we had the RBA's board meeting last weekend. That was replete with conflicts. So a lot to digest and ruminate on as we continue our daily tempo of trading. For those who don't know, I'm a portfolio manager. And Yingers is a portfolio management director at Coolabah Capital Investments. We are responsible for running $11 billion in global fixed income strategies. We typically execute around $700 million of fixed income trades daily. I think we've executed north of $50 billion of bond trades in the first few months of 2024 to date. So we're very engaged in the market. My team comprises about 47 executives, including 11 traders and portfolio managers and 18 global analysts. So Yingers, where should we start?
Chris, why don't we do a quick recap of what happened in April?
As always, sharp as attacking us, and I think that makes eminent sense. So April was a complex month for markets, with equities absolutely hammered and down as much as 4.5% in the US. Of course, Bitcoin, that massive risk amplifier, fell 15%. As long-term risk-free government bond yields spiked on inflation concerns, while Coolabah's floating rate portfolios all reported very strong returns in the month. The data disseminated over April, Yingers, extended Coolabah's core thesis that demand-side services inflation will remain stubbornly sticky, and as goods price deflation or disinflation subsides, compel a re-acceleration in the overall core inflation pulse. And there have been consistent upside surprises in much of the global activity data, and in particular in respect of the overall core inflation data released in the US, Europe, UK, Australia, New Zealand, with a ongoing theme of very strong underlying services inflation overwhelming decelerating goods prices.
Indeed, Chris. And in the month of April, we saw benchmark 10-year government bond yields soar higher in the US, up 48 basis points in the month. In Australia, they were up 45 basis points. In the UK, they were up 41 basis points. In New Zealand, up 31 basis points. Germany, up 29 basis points. And Italy, up 20 basis points. You get the drift. And as these discount rates climbed, equities finally started to capitulate in the US. And we saw the S&P down 4.2% and the NASDAQ was off 4.4%. In Europe, the Euro stocks was down 3.2%. In Australia, the ASX was down 3%. And New Zealand, the local stock market there was down 1.2%. With the one standout, though, being the UK, and we saw the FTSE actually up 2.4% in the month. And this meant that the long duration fixed rate bond indices were belted, with the Bloomberg Global Aggregate Corporate Bond Index declining 1.9%, while its zero duration or floating rate equivalent returned 0.85%. The fixed rate benchmark in Australia, known as the Ausbond Composite Bond Index, actually lost 2% during the month. And while synthetic credit default swap, or otherwise known as CDS indices, moved wider over April, which means that higher spreads denote greater risk, cash credit spreads on actual bonds generally tightened. And this dissimilitude probably reflected hedging activity in the more liquid CDS indices. In the US, the CDX IG and CDX high yield indices went wider by 2 basis points and 27 basis points respectively over the month. And in Europe, the main and crossover were wider by 2 basis points and 21 basis points respectively. So quite similar to the US move. In contrast, though, cash corporate bond spreads were tighter in the US, tighter by 3 basis points. In Europe, they were tighter by 2 basis points. And in Australia, five-year major bank senior bond spreads contracted by about 5 basis points. If we look at Tier 2, five-year major bank Tier 2 bond spreads fell 8 basis points, and five-year AT1 hybrid spreads declined by 25 basis points. We did see cash spreads on UK corporate bonds increase by about 2 basis points, though. And Chris, your favorite topic besides fixed income, crypto. That was definitely not spared. So we saw Bitcoin plunge from $70,000 to $59,000 over the month. On the other hand, that proven inflation hedge, gold, appreciated by 2.5% over the same period. Coolabah's floating rate portfolios performed robustly in April, and this included the A-plus rated daily liquidity and zero duration floating rate high yield fund, which is up 1.1% net retail fees, while our long short opportunities fund was up 1.1%, also net of retail fees, and long short credit fund was up 1% net. The lower volatility A plus rated daily liquidity and zero duration RBA cash plus 1 and 1.5% strategies known as the Smarter Money Fund and the Short Term Income Fund with the ticker FRNS were up about 0.6% net retail in the month. The full capital structure ETF known as HBRD or the BetaShares Active Australian Hybrids ETF also had a solid April, and that delivered 0.86% net of retail fees, including franking, over the month. These results compared to the Aus1 Floating Rate Note Index's 0.48% return. In the fixed rate or long duration space, Coolabah's active composite bond fund with the ticker FIXD beat its benchmark composite bond index by about 0.52% net of retail fees. And over the 12 months to April, we're pleased to say that Coolabah's strategies have yielded some great results. In the floating rate domain, this has included the long short credit fund, which was up 12.2% net of retail fees and up 14.6% if we are looking at the Kiwi dollar unit class, and up 14.2% in the US dollar unit class. The long short opportunities fund was up between 11.7% to 12% net of fees. The floating rate high yield bond fund was up 11.6% net of fees. HBRD was up 7.3% net of retail fees, including franking. And the short term income fund was up 6.7%, while the Smarter Money Fund was up 6.7% also net of retail fees. Now, Chris, you wrote on the weekend that the RBA's board meeting last week was punctuated by conflicts. Can you explain what precisely you mean by that?
For sure, Yingers. The bottom line is that the contradictions in the RBA's communications reveal policy conflicts that could continue to erode its already embattled credibility. Following the release of its May board statement, analysts proclaimed that the central bank had retained its neutral posture and not considered lifting interest rates, despite a 96th percentile upside surprise to its inflation and employment forecast. So this was just immediately after the board meeting and the publication of the statement. So in a note released right after the board meeting, but crucially just prior to the Governor Michelle Bullock's actual press conference, Goldman Sachs said the board had, quote, reiterated the RBA's neutral forward guidance. In a similar vein, IFM Chief Economist Alex Joiner surmised that the RBA was, quote, still some way away from considering even a tightening bias. At the same time, CBA echoed these sentiments, concluding that the RBA, quote, did not reinstate its hiking bias and maintain the neutral stance it shifted to at the March meeting, end quote. So, Yingers, while neither the board statement nor Bullock's press conference introduction made any reference whatsoever to the fact that the central bank had actually considered raising rates at its board meeting for the first time since February, that is precisely what subsequent media questioning unearthed. Asked by an ABC journal about whether the RBA had any debate at all about interest rate settings, Bullock revealed that, quote, the board did discuss the option of raising interest rates, end quote. With the benefit of this new information, longtime RBA watcher Terry McCrann described it as a, quote, neutral stance with a slight hiking tilt. In the Australian newspaper, McCrann continued, quote, Bullock explicitly disclosed that the board had, and he put this in full capitalized letters, discussed a rate hike. She quite deliberately did not add that it had also discussed a rate cut.
All I can say, Chris, is that alleging neutrality while considering lifting rates seems fairly contradictory.
Yeah, Yingers, and I think our chief macro strategist, Kieran Davies, agrees with you, because as he put it, quote, Martin Place delivered conflicting messages on monetary policy, retaining a neutral policy bias, even as the board discussed raising rates for the first time since February.
I guess, Chris, you could say that one explanation for these contradictions is that the board-produced statement reflects a more dovish posture than the staff recommendations. And there are additional inconsistencies that hint at this potential tug of war. The RBA had previously asserted that it had no appetite for any more delays in restoring inflation to its implied 2.5% target, which it forecast would not be secured until late 2026.
Yeah, Yingers, and again, I can quote here from Bullock's actual words, and apologies, folks, for my accents, but I just want to make it clear that these are not my words. So Bullock says, the board has been clear that it has a low tolerance for allowing inflation to return to target more slowly than currently expected. Accepting this would risk eroding public credibility in our commitment to low and stable inflation. And he is on this particular point surrounding the RBA's very sluggish approach to its target and delaying the return to target. Bullock's predecessor as governor, Phil Lowe, has acknowledged that the RBA was, quote, taking a bit more time than some other countries to return inflation to target on the basis that doing so can preserve some of the gains in the labour market. Put a bit more bluntly, Ingers, this is the incongruous needle that the RBA is trying to thread. They're trying to get inflation back to normal while not creating job losses. But with labour cost fueled services inflation running at 6 to 7% per annum, the only credible way to normalise inflation is by attenuating wage growth through higher unemployment. And Ying, as many observers felt that Bullock potentially shifted the goalposts on the RBA's timetable for returning inflation to the central bank's 2.5% target. So rather than having a low tolerance for any further delays, Bullock threw up two different tests. And they were, quote, if inflation expectations were starting to shift and it was going to take markedly longer to come back to target, then we might have to be thinking about whether or not there needs to be an interest rate rise.
Chris, it definitely leaves everyone scratching their heads because it's unclear what a, quote, markedly longer miss of the inflation target actually means. It's similar to the governor claiming policy was, quote, restrictive on 9 occasions when its research suggests the cash rate is only a smidge above the 3.8% neutral rate. All the while, we see inflation and unemployment continuing to surprise with their strength, which would imply that policy is not, in fact, that restrictive. Following the March quarter inflation shock, most economists predicted the RBA would have to upgrade its consumer price index estimates for 2025 and 2026, and therefore elongate the return to its target. There was nonetheless also a suspicion that the RBA might try to fudge the forecast to avoid this outcome. And that's what transpired. While the RBA lifted its 2025 inflation projections, the 2026 numbers were miraculously unchanged.
Yeah, Yingers. I mean, I had certainly a very strong sneaking suspicion that whilst pretty much all economists were calling upgrades based on the aforementioned inflation shock, the March quarter shock, to the RBA's 25 and 26 numbers, that they'd somehow, you know, thread the needle and leave the forecasts in 2026 unchanged. And as you said, that's what happened. Our very dry and dour chief macro strategist, Kieran Davies, commented that, quote, the revisions do not seem to hang together. While the RBA upgraded its near-term forecast for underlying inflation, it still thinks inflation will slow to 2.6% by mid-2026. And Davies continues, the longer-term forecasts were left unchanged because the RBA assumed the cash rate would stay higher for longer, noting that the market was pricing in some near-term risk of a hike, whereas previously the cash rate assumption was a mechanical average of market pricing and economists' expectations, the RBA dropped the economists' forecasts. And then we get Davies' punchline, quote, this seems something of a stretch, partly because the RBA's own modelling points to a long lag between higher interest rates and inflation, while the RBA simultaneously forecast a slower rise in the unemployment rate to a marginally lower peak of 4.3% compared to the previous estimate of 4.4%, despite a higher assumed cash rate. Effectively, what Kieran's saying is that the higher interest rates in the RBA's forecast profile are unlikely to have the effect that the RBA assumed they'd have in 2026, which it needed to leave the 26 numbers unchanged. And if we want some independent views on this, Yingers, the RBA's former head of economic analysis, Jonathan Kearns, who's now chief economist at Challenger, has just published some really cool research on this subject. And Kearns finds that the central bank's, quote, forecasting errors since the surge in inflation in 2021 have been very large. And Kearns continues, quote, 10 of the 14 largest positive forecasting errors at an 18-month horizon have occurred since 2021. Since the takeoff in inflation in 2021, the cumulative miss has been 11%. And by the time inflation returns to target in 2026, the cumulative inflation miss will be 14% greater than was expected back in early 2021. Kearns says that even if the RBA forecasts turn out to be correct, inflation will have been above 3% for over 4 years. That large variance in inflation, he continues, risks undermining confidence in the RBA's inflation target, making its job more difficult. And Yingers, with presidential candidate Donald Trump actively threatening the US Federal Reserve's powers and concerns that the RBA's kowtowing to domestic politics here in Australia, there are many analysts who believe that central banks are trying to manage their own political risks as elections loom around the world. And here the IMF says, calls are growing for interest rate cuts, and even if they are premature, they are likely to intensify as half the world's population votes in 2024. And they continue, quote, risks of political interference in central bank decision-making and personnel appointments are rising. So, Yingyuan, what are the key takeaways for investors? I guess our view is that central banks probably will need to consider hiking rates if services inflation remains stubbornly sticky, but they're going to try to avoid doing so like the plague. The Fed very clearly wanted to cut in June and September prior to the US election on the 5th of November. Here in Australia, the RBA has been remarkably dovish in the face of massive upside shocks to its inflation and employment forecasts. It actively tried to hide the fact that it had considered lifting rates at its May board meeting with no reference at all to the contemplation of a hike in either the board statement or Governor Bullock's opening remarks to her press conference. And it was only thanks to journalists interrogating her that we actually discovered that a hike had actually been actively contemplated. And in this environment, I think we're going to get an ongoing risk rally until such a time as the data overwhelmingly demonstrates that we need a regime change in rates. And that is firstly, the complete evisceration of any possibility of cuts. And then secondly, pricing in the probability of hikes. And in the US in particular, I think you're going to need the pricing in of some probability of hikes in order to precipitate a regime change in risk pricing and specifically equity valuations. So that's all we have, folks, this week. Look forward to re-engaging with you next week. Hopefully you're enjoying the high frequency tempo of these weekly summaries. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to email us at info@coolbarcapital.com.
This podcast does not provide financial advice. It is not an invitation to invest in any financial product, and the information in it should not be relied on for any decisions. All views expressed represent the personal opinions of the speaker and do not represent the view of any other party. If this recording contains reference to any financial products, that reference does not constitute advice or a recommendation and should not be relied upon. Listeners in Australia are encouraged to visit the moneysmart.gov.au website to obtain information regarding financial advice and investments.